Welcome to the Agency in Focus, NASA, sponsored by Leidos. Now, here's your host, Tom Temin.
For NASA, pondering its next round of space exploration, an important distinction-driving strategy is how far away its astronauts will go, that is, low Earth orbit or deep space. Jason Krusan is NASA's Director of Advanced Exploration Systems. In part one of a comprehensive interview, he describes how NASA makes this distinction. Let's start with where low Earth orbit ends in terms of NASA's programs and where it's no longer low Earth orbit. Does that include the moon, or is the moon classified along with Mars?
Yeah, so really we think about the amount of time it takes to get humans back. It's kind of the deciding factor where we believe deep space and deep space activities kind of start. And with the moon, you go from low Earth orbit, you go from hours of being able to return a human to the surface of the moon, to the safety of, a hospital and those types of things, to now going to the moon, where you're going to be away anywhere from 3 to 20 plus 30 days away. And if something were to go wrong, your abort to get back to Earth is measured in days. And then as you progress towards Mars, then you start measuring in months if something were to go wrong.
And that is truly unknown territory.
Truly is, yes. Even lunar activities during the Apollo program, we were still on the short order of those return number of days to get back to Earth. So even our very initial missions into cislunar space that we're planning actually go beyond anything we ever experienced during Apollo.
And for the forthcoming lunar missions atop the SLS program, then NASA will be looking to take people to different spots, even further dark side and so forth, of the moon itself.
Yeah, so we're talking about putting something in orbit around the moon. The gateway is our concept that we're working on today. And that enables then a whole host of surface activities and also is the critical infrastructure piece that we need to build our spaceship that would take us to Mars.
And with respect to that period of space beyond the moon, NASA is looking at something called the Gateway. Tell us how that fits in.
Yeah, so much like when we went to explore the western side of the United States, you need an outpost by which you start and run campaigns from. So what we're looking at as a gateway is an orbiting kind of outpost that would be in orbit around the moon that allows us to stage, say, landers out of and reuse landers to the surface of the moon. It also serves as kind of our staging point that we could build up the spaceship to go out to Mars. So you can think about it as like a spaceport, a dry dock, like in ship terms, of a place that we build ships, we refurbish ships, and then we actually stage missions out of. In and of itself, it has a whole host of activities that are going on, but it also plays that kind of critical infrastructure role from everything from communications to just orbit maintenance, conducting science experiments from itself. But that infrastructure piece is equally as critical to enable the next phase of human spaceflight.
And does NASA envision the gateway to be manned?
Yeah, we talk about it being crew-tended, meaning that in any given year, we'll do at least a mission to it, anywhere from 30 to 90 days. We could do more of those more often if we needed to for any specific scientific reasons or infrastructure reasons, but nominally 30 to 90 days, and then we would have kind of experiments going on whenever we're not there. Also, it has a robust communications capabilities that, so say if robotic missions are on the surface of the moon being conducted, it acts as kind of a geocommunication satellite, much like we have here on Earth. So it would enable all those even when the crew is not there.
But sending a crew to tend to it in the way you describe, then in some ways, it mirrors the challenge that you have with space exploration beyond near Earth orbit for the people going to it and beyond it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, these missions, your typical trip out to the moon is 3 days transfer, takes another day or so to get into the actual orbit where the gateway will be. That orbit that the gateway's in takes about 6 or 7 days to orbit around the moon. So when you go, you kind of stay for one orbit around the moon or two orbits around the moon. So it will be very much like the initial steps of breaking the bounds of Earth and being away from Earth, where you're if something goes wrong, you got to wait on an order of at least days, and it'll start teaching us how do we live away from Earth safely.
And hope you don't need an appendectomy. We're speaking with Jason Krusan. He's Director of Advanced Exploration Systems at NASA. And I think at this point, I'd like you to, if you could, briefly describe the strategic principles for sustainable exploration, because I think if people understand those, it won't seem so much like science fiction, what it is you're envisioning.
Yeah, I mean, so if you think about different principles that we judge things by, I mean, scientific discovery has helped enable a whole host of new architectures, new ways of doing things. We now have a much better understanding of the water cycle on the moon, a water cycle on Mars, throughout the solar system. So we learn from those opportunities that we hear about and see and discover. We also learn about through technology advancement. I'll give an example of the International Space Station today. It's very large, it's the size of a football field, in acreage of solar arrays. The same amount of solar arrays today to produce the same amount of power will only be about 20% the size that they are for the International Space Station. So our gateway that we're planning produces at least about 70-some kilowatts of power at the solar arrays. That's about 50% what the International Space Station power production is, and it's less than 20% the size of the overall solar array. So advancements in technology, miniaturization of electronics, better approaches to make electronics more tolerable to radiation exposure. All those types of things are enabling us to make exploration, the challenge of exploration, a little easier. We also learn about critical operations and not forgetting how to send humans into space. After long breaks in human spaceflight activity, there's a bit of a relearning curve for the next generation workforce. So we're wanting to see a natural progression from low Earth orbit to deep space. We always like to live in the budget realities we have, too. The pace at which we make progress, a lot of that is based on the budget that we have, in addition to the scientific and technology breakthroughs that are there. So we also balance for that factor. There's a whole emerging industry. The entire industrial base is fundamentally incredibly different than it was, say, at the beginning of the International Space Station development. We now have a robust space economy that we can leverage and buy services from or buy components from, where NASA isn't the sole keeper and developer of that entire industrial base. So all these are kind of principles that we balance and value on how to go about coming up with our sustainable approach for human spaceflight and sustainable exploration overall.
And you also mentioned the gradual buildup of capability. That means that you can't send someone to Mars now, but over some period of time, that capability would be gradually arrived at.
Yeah, and gradual buildup also means building infrastructure. So a lot of people talk about programs, so this program or that program, but the way to think about it is we're building a certain set of capabilities, in this case an orbiting platform, a communications relay function that it has, some lander capabilities, the ability for our life support systems to be sustained off planet, away from Earth. So we build all those capabilities, so the next thing we build is that much easier, so we don't have to, we're not starting from scratch on one program to the next. We're actually building on one capability to the next and leaving some of that critical infrastructure behind as we go from each stage to each stage. That makes the next step easier. So that's kind of what we're looking at for the gradual buildup.
And also the idea of always having people in space beyond the space station, the continuity of human spaceflight. What's the principle there?
Yeah, the continuity of human spaceflight is, in the past, and people even talk about it today, is the Apollo program was a series of what we would call sorties, short-duration missions to the surface. That's great. We learned a lot from that. However, at the end of the Apollo program, we still had flight hardware to fly two or three more missions. And we were presented with the classical challenge of, do we continue on exploring, or is it worth the risk? And at that time, people made a judgment call of stopping the risk acceptance or stopping the will to explore for that period of time, because there wasn't really a need to keep on going. And I think continuation of human spaceflight with a platform that's out there conducting research on a regular basis versus kind of singular missions allows us to have an opportunity to keep on weighing that risk and keep on continuing human spaceflight, and doesn't allow us the easy way out, and doesn't allow society the easy way to say, oh, we're just going to stop doing the hard things. So to me, it's we should always be pushing the barrier of knowledge and technology and taking those risks in a reasonable way to keep on exploring.
Jason Krusan is NASA's Director of Advanced Exploration Systems. In part two of the interview, Krusan delves into some of the detailed challenges of sustaining human life for a two-year journey to Mars. I'm Tom Temin.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.
It's no picnic flying 2 years to Mars and then maybe back again. Yesterday, we heard from Jason Krusan, the Director of Advanced Exploration Systems at NASA, on the program dimensions of a voyage to Mars. In part two of the interview, we focused on the actual issues of continuity of human spaceflight, of keeping people alive for a long time. I mean, one thing we learned early on, I guess, is that everybody has to eat and everybody has to poop, basically. And that drove the design of the crew modules. What's next beyond those basics?
Yeah, so with the International Space Station today, we are learning how to do what we call closed-loop environmental life support systems. And in that yesterday's water is tomorrow's coffee kind of thing. Just don't think about it too much. But water recycling systems, air recycling systems, waste management systems, all that to allow us to minimize the need for resupply from Earth. Right now, we're at 85% water reuse on board the International Space Station. And a couple of the technologies we're working on today are going to get us up to about 93 to 97% on water reuse. We reuse a lot of the air already today, scrubbing out CO2. We're actually producing water as a byproduct of some of our CO2 removals, along with the way we make oxygen on board. We crack water and produce hydrogen and oxygen. As well. And so all those technologies to allow us to not require resupply are incredibly important until we get to destinations. So the transit to Mars, the transit out and living in orbit around the moon, we want to minimize that supply chain. And then once we get to the surface of the moon and get to the surface of Mars, those same fundamental technologies are what allow us to extract resources from that planetary body and utilize them as well.
It's almost like you're trying to get as close as possible to a perpetual motion machine, but knowing that you've eventually got to give it a little nudge.
Yeah, here on Earth, I mean, every one of our little cities and towns is that same kind of concept. But we have a plethora of resources on Earth. And a common American household, you drink the same water every 600 or plus days or more. We're drinking the same water every 6 days on the International Space Station. It's the environmental factor, the where you're living, what's sustaining your life is a much smaller system, and we don't have the ability to rely on the Earth system to help assist those things.
And what about the reliability and sustainability of the systems of the machinery itself? Because you can't carry up six redundant systems because of the weight and space. So that means whatever it is that's processing the CO2 and the oxygen and turning urine into coffee, whatever, has got to be really reliable to a degree that may not be possible now.
Yeah, we like to talk about the kind of the sexiness of the technology and being really hard and all that. But to be honest, what we try to drive for is minimal complexity to get exactly what you're talking about, high reliability. And so when something fails, let's let it fail in a way that it's maybe a simple filter change out or something that can be easily fixed. We've been making advancements in advanced manufacturing of parts. The entire 3D printing industry that's terrestrial-based today, we've been modifying those printers and flying them in space, so we print plastic parts and metallic parts and all that, so that we can even do some limited repair and printing of spare parts on orbit. Otherwise, the only choice you have, as you described, is redundancy, being that we bring all the spares with us. That's not very practical when you want to go all the way to Mars.
And the Orion, which can hold about six people if it needs to, is maybe the size of a biggish SUV. But is that big enough for people to remain comfortable, let's say, for 2 years if they had that, if they were someday to go to Mars that long?
It isn't. In fact, I mean, Orion's kind of geared towards missions kind of less than 30 days, 21-day, 25-day kind of missions. It's really the transit piece that you want. It has the reliability of its systems are extremely high reliability. But as you say, that the volume that people live in is rather small. So what we look at for Mars transit missions is something about 10 to 20 times size, bigger than Orion in total volume. But with the same type of reliability that Orion systems have. And in fact, if we brought an Orion with us to Mars, it would serve as one set of environmental life support systems, and we may have another set in that habitat where people are living, and that we may have a little bit of redundancy in order to get that overall reliability that we're looking for.
Jason Krusan is NASA's Director of Advanced Exploration Systems. I'm Tom Tamman.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.
We're speaking with Jason Krusan. He's Director of Advanced Exploration Systems at NASA. And what about the part of the body above the shoulders for people to remain that long going somewhere at someday, a year, 18 months, whatever it is, you know, depending on an asteroid or Mars? What about the psychological aspects? Are people supposed to live in a regular 24-hour sleep and living cycle and so on?
Yeah, we've done a lot of training and testing in isolation of crews for long periods of time, and our International Space Station obviously is a living experiment lab for those as well. The connection back to Earth is incredibly important. The ability to look out the window from low Earth orbit and see Earth. Now, as we go away from Earth, that dot in the window, the Earth changes to a dot, and eventually you have Earth and Moon as a dot in the window. So the ability to do communications back to Earth, increasing some of our data bandwidth in order to go out there will be incredibly important. Having important tasks for the astronauts to conduct, both scientific and technology tasks, or even general maintenance of keeping people busy. But in many ways, their day will be like our day here. So that also means some private time and even personal time while they're traveling, the ability to communicate back to Earth. Now, over time, that's not a live telephone call anymore. It's much like the way we communicate, or my children communicate today, in recorded messages and sharing of thoughts back and forth that are kind of asynchronous, but still incredibly important.
Because Mars is, what, several minutes away by light, correct?
Yeah, by the time you're there, it's about a 40-minute round trip.
Wow.
For messages.
Yeah, so that even texting would take a long time, I suppose.
Yeah.
And what about the types of people that are going up? I mean, the reports that come from the space station are always rosy. Everybody loves everyone and they all get along. But in reality, as NASA monitors what's going on there in the space station, do people in fact always get along, or are there conflicts? And would that be something that would be going into the selection of the type of people? And would there be need to be intervention from time to time, even if it takes 40 minutes?
Yeah, so I mean, we do a lot of work on the front end when we're selecting astronauts in the interview processes, and we look at those team dynamics and team building skills and their ability to work well with others. That's probably even more important than just their fundamental technology, or in the case of some of our pilots, the fighter pilot type skills. That working as a team is incredibly important. Yes, when you work with folks in a close proximity for long periods of time, that does create its own stress. So even today, we have ways for our crew members to talk back at home, talk through issues like that with either peers and or healthcare professionals if those types of things come up. But it's you're also thinking about, you got to think about what you're doing at the time. you're on the first trip to Mars, or you're on the first crew going to the surface of the moon. I think even the most stressful situation like that that would potentially come up, you actually have to step back and say, "Wow, look what we're doing." And I can tough it out for a week or two, or I can tough it out for a year or 2 years or 3 years for a Mars class mission because of the enormity of the accomplishment that you're about to achieve.
And what about the international role? Because, you know, in SLS and in Orion, there are international players along working with NASA that maybe not have been present in decades past.
Yeah, so even with the Gateway, we are looking at international partner contributions to the overall Gateway infrastructure. Things like habitats and robotic arms, all those are in discussions with our partners today. So we won't be building the Gateway alone. We'll be building it with our partners. And then with that, our partners will be flying crews and doing some, their own scientific objectives and joint science activities that we are doing today. So, yeah, the international partners are important from many aspects of allowing the U.S. to lead the global human exploration activities for the world, the contributions of diverse backgrounds and different technologies and different capabilities, contributions of towards the overall cost of doing some of these extremely difficult missions. So international partners will absolutely play a role in those, and just like they are today.
And one last question on the human aspect of very long flights that are going very far away. Do you consider how to deal with possible major life changes on Earth for those people out there and their families? And also, what about the possibility of political or some other kind of national change for people either in the United States, or there might be international partners aboard at some point going to Mars?
Yeah, so even in the space station's lifetime of the past 20 years, with crews on board, we have seen those major political events. We've seen major tragedies happen, even to crew members' families on board. And that's actually what makes human spaceflight human. And being able to tell that the perspective of that story from where they sit, whether it's in a significant event like September 11th and the view of being able to look down from space on an activity or tragedy like that, to personal events that occur within a family member's life. It is absolutely, it's part of what we are as humans. I also think exploration is part of what we are as humans. So that's part of the storytelling that I think is part of our commitment for our crew members and NASA and our international partners to tell. That's why we send humans.
Jason Krusan is Director of Advanced Exploration Systems at NASA. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Agency in Focus NASA, sponsored by Leidos on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency in Focus.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.